Oh, I want to use this occasion of the formal beginning of the retreat to welcome you all, and also occasion to welcome the people who are online. Welcome. And I will take off my mask, as we talked about earlier, that the teachers, when they're teaching, will take their masks off. And that we'll be testing ourselves every day with the idea that if we're negative, it takes a while before we're contagious. And so we're catching it every day if we do it. So that's the plan. And then maybe it's a little bit easier to hear me. Is it loud enough, the speakers? So I want to welcome you all. And I evoked this afternoon the idea that there's no them here. So it's a little bit funny then for one of us to welcome us. What makes the most sense is if we all welcome each other. And so for those of you online, you could welcome all of each other by bowing, into your little tile and a way of saying hello and welcome to your fellow online participants. And all of us here, we can share in the welcome. But before we do, the idea is that we're welcoming all of who we are. That's how the Dharma really works best. So no matter who you are, what your background, what your circumstances, it's here. We practice with all of who we are. So whatever gender you are, whatever race you are, whatever socioeconomic status you are, whatever nationality, ethnicity, whatever physical and mental, emotional capacities you have, whatever unique qualities that you have that's unusual but your own unique thing, whatever your police record is, whatever your political party is, there's your body type, it just goes on, The idea is, it's hard to start that without feeling I'm leaving someone out. But the idea is that all of you is here, is welcomed. So perhaps in that spirit that we're all doing this together, maybe we could all kind of do a welcoming bow to each other. Once for each other here in person. And then if we do it a second time, we can kind of think of the people who are online, and I'll bow particularly deeply for all of us, so that I think they see me. So my group can represent all of you. So just a few things logistically about being here in the hall. The idea is to only reserve one spot for yourself. So not a chair and a floor spot, but just choose one or other that's going to be your place, and hopefully that will work out. And if you would need to bring a chair in, there are folding chairs, black mesh chairs, or the rolling turquoise chairs downstairs, or from a chair from your room if that's best for you. If you're here, you can put it on top of your seat here. You move your zabaton aside, fold it in half, and put it here if you want to sit in a chair sometimes, if there's no chairs on the edge. There are some chairs which are unreservable, meaning they're first come, first serve. So if you're sitting cross-legged on the floor, you need to take a break and sit in a chair. Hopefully you'll find one, but you can also bring one in and put in your spot here if you want. For those of you in the chair who want to often sit on a cushion, there might not be any cushions in here, so you might have to go do it in another room or out in the foyer or something. So hopefully everyone's fluid and kind of relaxed around a little bit unfortunate circumstance with that we are not all together in one big room like we used to be before COVID. But tomorrow I'll do a posture instruction. And if you've never heard posture instructions, I'd encourage you to stay for it. It's at 11 o'clock. And if you have a work meditation at 11 and you want to stay for the posture instruction, leave a note for the managers and the kitchen mentor, both, just so they both know. And then they'll try to find someone to replace you, or we'll figure something out. And the sooner you do that, the better. The easier is to take care of it. And for those of you who are going to be bell ringers and sitting up here, you can sit either in this chair here where May is sitting, or you sit here where I'm sitting. And if you've never hit this bell before, come in here during a break, like after a meal or something, or during the meal or something, and practice it. The reason for that is, for someone who's never done it before, you'll surely hit it lightly, but not light enough. And it'll come as a clang. And it's a little bit hard for people sitting and meditating. But if you do it super duper light, you can always redo that. But you can't really redo the clang. So come here and practice it. It's a very light touch with a, you want to kind of almost like dangle the striker on your edge, you know, in your fingers, almost like just like really loose. And then the kind of like, it's more like you're grazing the bell than you are striking it. And then also I ask all of you who are bell ringers tomorrow that the schedule for tomorrow, it says first full day schedule, is up here. And I'd encourage you, or ask you to, when you sit down to meditate, check the schedule again to make sure you know how long the sitting's supposed to be, because it's pretty common that people get the different sittings confused because they're variable lengths. Some are 45, some are 30, some are 35. And so, which is it? And so, it's not uncommon for someone the first day to ring the bell too early, which is not too bad, or too late. Yeah. Like 15, you know, that which is, some people get kind of impatient, mostly the managers, because they're being responsible. So anyway, so check, and so that you make sure, double check, triple check, so you. So hopefully that's enough for the kind of logistical beginning here. The theme of the retreat. So here at IRC, most of our week-long retreats, or most of our retreats, have themes that connect the different Dharma talks and then sometimes the instructions together in a whole. And to introduce the theme for this retreat, I'd like to offer you a little saying that relates to this practice that we do. And so the saying is that in doing mindfulness practice, doing vipassana practice, if there's a difference between the actual and the ideal, always choose the actual to bring your attention to. If you chase after the ideal that isn't actually happening, you kind of miss what this practice is really about. So even if you think you're supposed to be like the ideal, you're still chasing something. Just be with the actual. And what happens for many of us, more often than we care for, the actual is that there are challenges in keeping our mindfulness present, staying in the present moment. And that difficulty to stay in the present moment should not be considered a problem. It's really where the teachings, that's where the transformation happens. That's where we discover ourselves. That's where we can see ourselves in a deeper way. And so, don't intentionally distract yourself, But the very things that make it difficult for you to be present, that's the actual. And just like when I was in high school, we had driver's ed, where they wanted to teach us how to drive. For people who do this practice here, we need to understand that there's a basic course that we need to take called hindrance ed. And you know that we and so one of the things that we're supposed to do as Vipassana students of this practice, believe it or not, we're supposed to become experts on the hindrances. Think of yourself like working for a master's thesis, a master's degree or a graduate degree in hindrances. It's that important. So don't make them up. Don't like decide to, like, I'm going to work on a really good hindrance today and just kind of drum it up. Just wait until it finds you. But when it finds you, don't be discouraged. It's actually hindrance school. You've arrived. Because we want to learn, not only do we want to learn about the hindrances, how they work, how we relate to them, how they influence us, how we influence them. There's a whole ecology of hindrances that's understanding the ecology of our own mind and heart. But we also want to learn how to be present for something that is difficult, how to be present for something we don't like, that's uncomfortable for us, that we're fed up with, that we're ashamed of. All kinds of things can happen around the hindrances. And we want to learn how to be present for it in an effective, useful way. How to hold it compassionately, kindly, how to open with equanimity, how to see it so clearly that we're not caught in the grip of it. And what is it? What does it take to see something? What's the nature of seeing that can allow us not to be caught by what we see? That's kind of like the koan. That's the kind of like the spiritual question that hindrance ed has offered you to do. And whereas in driver's ed, there were very clear rules and things to learn that were given to me in high school. In hindrance ed, all us poor teachers can do is kind of do brushstrokes, ideas of, you know, how to look, how to be with it. The real education comes from being in the driver's seat of your life, and then as the hindrances come up, to meet them and become wise about them. So one of the themes of this retreat will be these hindrances. And those of you who don't know them, these are forces in the mind that very simply hinder our capacity to have a clear, present moment mindfulness. For the Buddha, it also meant those forces in the mind that not only get in the way of being mindful in the moment, but they also get in the way of having that mindfulness be continuous, that there's a concentration and continuity through time of being really here, settled in the present moment. So these five are the common word or name for them is sensual desire, ill will. Usually people call it sloth and torpor. I'll offer different names when my turn to talk about them. Restlessness and regrets and doubt. So some of them are paired up with two things. So there's five categories total. So we'll give five talks, one on each of these hindrances. But we're going to do something that maybe is a bit creative, depending how we do with it. And that is, we're going to match them up with some other teachings. And four of the hindrances we're going to match up with the four Brahmaviharas, the four divine abodes. So they're loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. But there's five hindrances. So what are we going to do with the fifth one? And for that, we're going to do the foundational. The Brahmaviharas are kind of relational attitudes and emotions, kind of relational attitudes of care, of love. there's one that is not, there's something that's a relational emotion that's considered very central to the teachings of the Buddha, that and to the Buddha himself, that I translate by the word care. In all the occurrences where the English translations say compassion, the Buddha taught with compassion, the word is actually not compassion, it's not karuna, it's anukampa, which I translate as care. And care is a kind of the foundation for the other Brahmaviharas, an umbrella term that comes to them all and stretches the boundaries of the caregiving feelings we can have beyond the four Brahmaviharas. So tomorrow I'll talk about this care in relationship to desire, to kind of hold those two together, kind of pair them up. And then goodwill, metta, loving kindness, will be paired up with ill will, aversion. Sympathetic joy, right, will be paired up with sloth and torpor. And then restlessness and regret will be paired up with karuna, with compassion. And doubt will be paired up with equanimity. So that's the kind of the plan. And so it turns out we get a little bit of both worlds. We get the actual and the ideal. And if we address the actual well, the hindrances well, if you learn how to work with them, what you might discover is that the ideals of compassion and love and all these things, they actually kind of show up to become the actual. Isn't that nice? So then we have some, you know, then they're no longer ideals that we want to try to live by, but they become something that lives in our hearts and expressed in the world in a nice way. And so we're not presenting these Brahmaviharas as something that you're supposed to or you should do, it's ideal, and if you don't have them, then somehow you're somehow, I don't know what, not a good Buddhist. But rather, the idea is to really explore all this, bring mindfulness to this whole world of the heart, the hindrances, the beauties of the heart, and really kind of be present and see what gets born, see what arises from your discovery, from your engagement, from your willingness to explore even what's uncomfortable. Can it willingness to explore what is hindering the very reason maybe you're here? And rather than being upset that you have these hindrances, you just realize, well, I'm working on my PhD. I guess it's hindrance ed class right now. And that's what you'll explore and become familiar with, learn how to work with. And if you can do this over your period of time, your life of doing mindfulness practice, to really kind of think of how important it is to learn how to work, practice with the hindrances, your practice will be so much easier. It'll be so much lighter, so much more effective for you than if you don't really learn this art of practicing with the hindrances. So that's the plan for this retreat. And so then we'll pause for a few moments. Breathe. And the formal beginning of the retreat is aligning ourselves, placing ourselves in the care of, committing ourselves to the refuges and the precepts. So those of you online, we didn't actually say this to them, you don't know this maybe. So we have a teacher trainee, very fortunate to have May Elliott here. And she's mostly here to kind of be in observing mode to as Matthew and I do our teaching. She's here to watch and see how that does and get the inside picture. But she'll have a few occasions to speak here to the hall and you get to know her a little bit. Those people here at IRC met her earlier today, but now I'm introducing May. So May is going to bring forth the refuges. And then Matthew will bring forth the precepts. And then with a little bit of luck, we'll be ready for bed at 8:30.
How's the sound? Great. Good evening, everyone. So as we begin our retreat together, I'd like to introduce the topic of refuge. Refuge is often considered a place of safety, a place that's free from fear and danger. And some of you may have come on retreat specifically to seek refuge. Refuge from some form of suffering or difficulty in your life. And perhaps there's a sense that in the world out there, there's not really a reliable source of happiness. There's sickness, old age, death. We don't get what we want. We get what we don't want. We lose what we love. It's not so easy, right? So is there a refuge from the difficulty of our lives? Well, fortunately, that is the promise of this practice. There is a refuge. So though we can't prevent pain, our suffering comes from our reaction to pain. And it's this reactivity that we can transform. And that's what we're doing here. So in Buddhism, the way that we transform the mind and the heart begins with the traditional practice of taking refuge. And we're taking refuge in the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So this will be really familiar for some of you, maybe new for others. So to take refuge in Buddha is to take refuge in the original teacher, the fully awakened one. So the Buddha was a human like us, who discovered the path and fruit of liberation. And in remembering the Buddha and taking refuge in Buddha, it's like remembering, oh, I too, as a human, have the capacity to be free from suffering. In taking refuge in Buddha, for me, I'm taking refuge in my own capacity for awakening. To take refuge in Dharma is to take refuge in the Buddha's teachings, the truth that was taught by him. The Dharma refers to the path of practice, and it's the path that's described in the Buddha's suttas, And these instructions really come to life when we practice them, when we practice the Dharma. And when we do, we begin to see things clearly. We get to see the true nature of things. And sometimes we might think of the Dharma simply as the truth. To take refuge in Sangha is to take refuge in community. This is the spiritual community. We're sitting here together with Sangha, whether we're in person or online. This is Sangha. It's the community of noble disciples, of spiritual practitioners that can help us walk the path of freedom. These are people like ourselves, of course, and we can include The yogis of past and those of present, our Buddhist ancestors, and our living comrades. So these are people who practice the Dharma, realize the Dharma, and carry on the Dharma for others. So one way we can see the utility of the three refuges is through the analogy of being lost in a jungle. So the Buddha is like a map maker, like a cartographer. And he has found his way out of the jungle of delusion and danger into a land of safety. And he has created a map, lucky for us, that can take us out of the jungle. So the Dharma is the map. And we need to study this map and bring our own effort to reading it and follow its instruction. And the Sangha are our guides on the path, the people who have learned how to read the map and know how to get through the ravines and the gullies and the swamps and can help us find our way out of the jungle. The cartographer, the map, and the guides. I want to acknowledge that sometimes in life or on retreat, we don't always feel like we have a map. We might just be suffering and really not know what to do and don't know how to get out of it, and we really feel lost. So I read an article recently that discussed the various human responses to being lost, like seriously lost in the wilderness. And there was a study done tracking hundreds of cases of different people who were lost in the backcountry. And it became clear that almost everyone who gets seriously lost has this one characteristic, this one behavioral characteristic. They all have the unbearable momentum, the unbearable desire to keep moving, to try to find their way out from being lost, unable to stop. The problem is, it's much less likely for search and rescue parties to be able to find someone if they are on the move. And here's what really stood out to me in the article. In almost all cases, the people who are found are the ones who sit still. And apparently it's really rare that someone who is lost will stop moving. And this is exactly why what you are all doing is so extraordinary. In the midst of your busy lives, lives where you may feel lost at times, you've chosen to sit down and be still. So if you find yourself experiencing difficulty on retreat, if you're feeling lost or doubting that you can find your way, the good news is that you've already sat down. You've already committed to this really skillful act. And then, if it's supportive to you, you might consider taking refuge in the Triple Treasure, reminding yourself that you have the capacity to awaken, taking refuge in Buddha, that you are equipped with a map of the Dharma, and you have the guidance of the Sangha to help you find your way home. So may the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha support you on your journey out of the jungle. And may you return to them for inspiration and guidance all along the path. So we'll now chant the refuges together in Pali, and we'll do this call and response. So we're going to start with paying homage to the Buddha. So this first piece I'll just read it to you in full. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. And so you know what you're chanting. That's, I pay homage to the Blessed One, the Exalted One, the Fully Enlightened One. So we'll do that three times, and then we'll move into the refuges. And we'll chant, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. Then we'll say, Dutiyampi, for the second time, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Then we'll say, Tatiyampi, for the third time, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So that's what we'll be going through together. Again, call and response. Namo tassa bhagavato. Arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato. Arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato. Arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. I'll now pass it to Matthew for the precepts.
So a warm welcome to all of you. We see you out there. Actually tried to crash the Zoom party earlier, but you were in breakout groups, and so. Delight to see the names on that list. And for those I don't know, I'm Matthew. So in the community hall in the opening, I quoted Zadie Smith asking that question, sort of wondering what is to be done with all this time other than filling it. And to be easy with time, to let time work on our heart, to stop the fixations with time, to stop building a sense of time, to make time an ally, as one of my teachers once said, just establish mindfulness and let time become your ally. To do all of this, to not be preoccupied in the ordinary way, entails a measure of trust, safety, that May was alluding to. And this kind of trust, reassurance, is supported by a kind of ambiance of non-vigilance. Yeah? An ambiance of non-vigilance. The sense of actually something deep in our being, that whatever is patrolling, actually that energy can just settle down. And we actually count on each other in ways that are maybe not immediately apparent. It feels, on the one hand, very, you know, it's just my experience, me, my retreat, my practice. But we impact each other in profound ways. And when we take good care to actually establish the ambiance of love, something in us actually lets down. And we have access to different aspects of our own heart. And I know for me, it really does look like I'm the one doing the teaching in this moment. But it's not exactly so. You are a condition of my mind. The list I saw, the people, the good hearts I saw on the list of people online, you, yeah, are a condition of my mind in this moment. And your care and your sincerity is actually, my teaching depends on it, actually. Yeah. Like, I don't have access to parts of my own heart and mind unless I actually feel the sincerity of your practice. We are interdependent in these ways. And we actually want to come to kind of pervade the field, the sense of like we really are doing something together. Even in all this silence, we really are doing something together. And the kind of the field of metta, of kindness becomes palpable. And it allows us actually to relinquish some of the vigilance that is characteristic of our life. And so we each contribute our goodness to the field here. And you can know that as you sit and as you move and as you go about your retreat, you are no doubt supporting the practice of others. Yeah? And one part of us is actually dedicated to supporting the retreat of everyone else. And one of the ways we do this, of course, is to commit our heart to trainings, the trainings, the precepts, trainings of non-harming. And so we take refuge in the Buddha. So some thousands of years ago said something that's still relevant today, which is remarkable. And the Dharma, this map, as May said, this map, and the Sangha, the community of practitioners here, that caretake the. We caretake this path of practice, and reverence for Sangha entails this measure of agreeing to non-harming, because we really need good friends on this path. We need a kind of ambiance of care. We need good friends because we're so porous and suggestible. When I enter like a fancy store, I start to believe in wealth. When I enter a fancy party, I start to believe in power. But I need places where we all need places where we believe in love. Yeah? Patience. Forgiveness. And so we come here and we each contribute our own heart to the kind of growing atmosphere of care, of reverence, of non-harm. And that's not incidental in our capacity to move more deeply into our heart. And so we're vowing really to carry ourselves such that others can deeply relax in our presence. Yeah, that no being need fear me. Yeah. And so in the messiness of retreat, in the messiness of the human condition, just how confusing it is, the precepts are these kind of very explicit commitments we make. And by committing to a kind of behavior of non-harming, what it means is no matter what happens in the field of our own experience, it belongs. Yeah. It actually gives more radical permission for life to arise in all its potency when we know we have these guardrails, these commitments of non-harming. And so the overarching principle of non-harming, this may look different for folks on Zoom, what your kind of commitments are around silence, these things. But the principle is non-harm, and concretely that looks like not taking life, yeah, not protecting life, not harming creatures, yeah. And all the layers of COVID protocol are in the spirit of non-harm. And the precepts